It is 93.3 WMMR in Philadelphia, and we have the company of a very talented gentleman who has a wide range of life and musical experiences. You certainly know him from Rage Against the Machine, Audio Slave, The Night Watchman, Prophets of Rage, and he's worked with an astounding number of other people. His name is Tom Morello, and we welcome you to Philly and to MMR.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. Always great to be in your city.
Pleasure to have you. It's a really cool thing that you're doing to introduce this album. How would you describe it? Because it seems like an intimate listening party. Yeah. Like back in the day, you'd get together with your friends and sit in a living room and put on an album. And it seems like a slightly larger version of the same thing.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I'm a child of the album age. And the idea of sitting in a room and listening to a super loud, brand new record that you've never heard before by an artist you're interested in is not an experience people tend to have these days. So this record's called The Atlas Underground. It's a solo record, but it's also a collaborative record. My idea was to create a sonic conspiracy and to forge an album that was led by my guitar playing with the bold ambition of creating a new genre of rock and roll, something that has Marshall Stack Fury, but it combines like EDM drops and some of the electronic of today with an astounding cast of characters from Marcus Mumford to Wu-Tang Clan, from Big Boy, Killer Mike, to Rise Against and Steve Aoki, from Portugal the Man to Bass Nectar and Knife Party. It's a record that's really been a labor of love.
You said when approaching these different artists, quote, here's my idea. I want to take components of what you do and components of what I do and make something with components nobody's ever done.
That's the idea, is that I was never really like a fan of EDM music, and a metal friend of mine turned me on to a group called Knife Party. In their music, I recognized some of my favorite parts of rock. It had tension and release. It was very aggressive. It had some of these huge moments like of going over the cliff with excitement. I said, well, what if we replace your synthesizers with my electric guitar to create this brand new alloy?
You use the word alloy, and I read that in an interview. Why alloy?
Yeah, because it's like different sort of metals coming together to make a brand new metal. Yeah. And so that was the guiding light of this album, was to really like put, like, this is my 17th studio album that I've made, and I really wanted to challenge myself as an artist and as a guitar player and make a record that was uncompromisingly a guitar record, but at the same time had, in some ways, like as a Trojan horse for 2018, an era in which young people are not drawn to practicing the guitar 8 hours a day. They're drawn to, you know, composing via Ableton and, you know, sort of computer. And the idea was to, for this record, to kind of be a Trojan horse and inflict my guitar playing on a new generation.
I love that. You had said that your wish for humanity is that everybody can become the person they were meant to be. And I love that, because I'm always fascinated with the idea of tapping into and fulfilling and living in our full potential. And there are those days when that's possible, and you get up and everything works, and then you think, I got it. I'm finally there. I've reached some form of enlightenment. Cool. It's going to be better from this point forward. The next day, you cannot tie your shoe. And you've studied this a lot, and I'm wondering what your take on that is.
Sure. So, I mean, the way I look at it is that many people are unable to become the people. I'm very fortunate. I think I was meant to be a guitar player and an activist, and I am. But many people are unable to become the people they were meant to be, often due to crushing poverty or circumstance. And the next doctor who might cure cancer could currently be working in a Vietnamese sweatshop making Nike shoes. Or the next Mozart might be in an Alabama prison because she got caught with weed when she was 16 years old and was, you know, the criminal justice system failed her. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's this tremendous amount of untapped human potential. And that's why I really believe that poverty isn't something that just happens. Poverty is a crime against humanity.
But I think this could also apply to every person, whether they're just living a regular life or not, because that idea of, what more could I do?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, like, you know, it sounds very, very cliched, but, you know, I took an Ivy League degree and I kind of threw it out the window and went to be a heavy metal guitar player in Hollywood, you know? So I really felt a calling and followed, you know, really what my heart told me to do. And here, this many years later, I'm doing an interview with you.
Well, there's two different people that come to mind when I think of potential tapped and untapped to a degree. They both come out of the Seattle scene. One is Chris Cornell and one is Dave Grohl. And although Chris, who you obviously worked with in Audio Slave, sampled and tapped his potential in different ways, and we got to hear that in different ways and different sounds, and that just his voice was an instrument in and of itself. But something clearly happened where he wasn't able to let his demons go. And then you see Dave Grohl on the other side, but a similar side of the street, who, you know, could have called it after Nirvana and said, you know, I did that. That's pretty cool. But he had this vision, this potential of his own that he saw and believed in and never let go of. And now everywhere I turn, Dave Grohl is involved in some other expression. So it seems like Chris got in touch with that potential and never quite lived it to the degree he wanted. I don't know if this is me juxtaposing this onto him, and that Dave did the same thing, but is living that. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
I think everybody's dealt a different hand. And with regards to Chris, was he was dealt a hand. You're like, demons is right. But what Chris managed to do for 52 years, which people who have that level of demons, he managed to harness them to create some of the greatest rock and roll of all time. He could not have sung like that or written those words if he did not have the internal composition that may have eventually led to his demise. You know what I mean? I miss him terribly, but that's the glass half full way of looking at it. It was, he couldn't have been the kind of great that he was. And I mean, I know Dave Grohl, but I don't know that he suffers from sort of depression or addiction issues or anything like that, in the way that I don't. So it's hard to get into the mindset of people who are like that. But I do know that Chris managed to harness that into a tremendous amount of awesomeness for a great many years.
You have a song on the new album, Every Step I Take, which I understand is about him, but tell us about it.
Yeah, there's a song called Every Step That I Take on the record, which was written by Matt Schultz of Cage the Elephant and myself, but it's performed by John from Portugal the Man and Weathen. And it's we're partnering with a suicide prevention organization called SAVE on this track, just to help. You know, in this day and age, I think it's very important. Like, if you break your arm, you go to the doctor to have it set. But you have sort of mental health issues or feel depression, there's often this kind of stigma about it. And erasing that stigma could very much save lives. And so this is the song that's like the single now. We're going to play it on Kimmel, you know, and stuff, in a way of kind of heightening awareness about suicide prevention, letting people know that there is always help with your friends, with your loved ones, and with professionals, and there is a way out. In the same way that if you had a, you know, like a broken arm, there's a way to make that better.
There's a stigma around it.
There's totally a stigma around it. But
around mental health issues in general.
Yes, there has been. And in my own family and in work associates and friends, you know, I've seen that where there's a reticence to seek help because you think that maybe people are going to look at you in a different way. But seeking that kind of help literally can save lives. And so if in part, you know, Chris's memory can live on in any good work that we do to help save and help other people.
Shine some light. There was a brief Audio Slave reunion at some point in the fairly recent history. And in that he got back with Soundgarden, it was my belief prior to this happening, and he'd been on my show a lot of times, that at some point he would have connected on a more full level with Audio Slave. Do you believe that?
Yeah, we had talked about it. I mean, we played together in January 17 at the anti-inaugural ball on the night of Trump's inauguration.
What was that like, being in that band again? And even for a night.
It was awesome. I mean, I hadn't played with Chris in many years, and a few months before that, he and I did a show in Seattle, like for a benefit show up there. So I got to play with him twice, you know, before he passed, which is really awesome. It was in the middle of a Prophets of Rage set, and Chuck and B and Lord leave the stage, and just me and Brad are out there playing like the beginning of Cochise. Now, Audio Slave hadn't played a show in 12 years, you know, and then all of a sudden out comes Chris Cornell, like singing Cochise, and like people lost their effing mind. I lost my mind. I was just like, crap, like there he is in his full like kind of rock god self, right, with the voice and the hair and the eyes and the whole thing. So it was really wonderful. We played three songs. We played Show Me How to Live, Like a Stone, and Cochise, and it was just awesome. And we talked afterwards about, you know, maybe doing some more, but alas.
Speaking of potential again, I heard that you were a fan of Star Trek, and going back to the original series, that concept I mentioned earlier of some days you have it together and some days you can't brings me to the episode where Dr. McCoy has to replace Spock's brain. And people are going, what the hell is he talking about? And he gets the knowledge, and all of a sudden he starts putting Spock's brain back in, and he goes, this is child's play. But then it starts wearing off, and he has to go on his gut instincts. And I don't know if you'd have any commentary on that.
First of all, I'm very pleased and somewhat surprised to have a good long Star Trek question in the middle of this interview. So thank you very much. Yeah, I'm a dyed-in-wool Trekkie, and I've had the honor to be both. I was in one of the movies and in the Voyager TV show. But anyway, I do remember that show where he went on his instincts, and you know, I think that you know that is certainly a big part of, like, I wouldn't say success in life, but sort of decision making is trusting yourself, but also do not disregard science.
Right. Well, back to Star Trek. Is it true that Rick Berman, the producer's daughter, was a big Rage fan?
Yeah. His kid. I'm not sure if it was his son or his daughter, but yeah, that was kind of my entry into that world.
That's so cool. And you got to be in two. You were in Voyager and one of the movies.
That's right, Insurrection. Yeah.
But your Insurrection part, you're so made up, I guess, that people.
If I was standing next to you, you wouldn't recognize. 5 hours of makeup, and I was like the only one. You know, you had to be there at 3 a.m. to start the makeup for the day, and I'm there with some other actors who are less enthusiastic about being in there at 3 a.m. getting the makeup on, and me, I'm like, it's Christmas morning, and we're here, and it's Star Trek. Isn't this awesome, guys? And they're like, rah, 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 with their SAG cards. I just did this to get the SAG card.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, I don't think you have any energy problems based on this brief interview we've had. So I want to ask you about a couple of other people you played with. Bruce comes to mind, and a couple of years ago, I think little Steven wasn't able to do a tour, and somehow you got in there, yeah. which I don't think people would expect. Yeah. And I love the unexpected in music, because music knows no boundaries. Yeah. Back to your album, you know, you've crossed all these genres, and musicians don't think in those terms. But how did that happen, and what was that like?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, I've done a lot of collaboration in the past, and one of my favorite ones was working with Bruce Springsteen over the course of 6 years, you know, on and off. And we've been friends for about 8 years before we ever played together. And I've made 4 records of like folk and Americana music, which is very much influenced by Bruce. And he'd been a few of my Night Watchman shows. And when little Steven was off doing his TV show, Lilyhammer, Bruce asked me to do an Australian tour. And while we were down there, he felt inspired, and we made a record. We made the High Hopes record and on tour. And that just, we just played together for, you know, a few years after that. And just watching him on a nightly basis and his commitment to awesomeness in, you know, from health to fitness to singing to entertaining an audience to having a message to making a family-like connection with the people you play for and the people you play with was really pretty incredible.
Back to Bruce for just a second, because he launched the Vote for Change concept. I think it was 2008, and they were trying to get young people to register to vote. And they went to swing states and in different towns in those states, they would have different artists. REM might be in one town, James Taylor in another, Bruce and John Fogerty and Pearl Jam in another. And it was pretty interesting. It was not terribly successful in its overall goal, but the idea of it was cool. You've talked about people saying, don't talk about politics, just play music. And yet, you know, some of the most legendary songs of all time, Ohio from Neil Young, is all about politics. I'm wondering, because your positions on things are pretty well known, I'm wondering if you've sat as close as I am to you with someone completely of an opposite view, and how you dealt with that, and what you took from him and he from you.
Sure. I mean, all the time. For me, there's no political litmus test to enjoying the music that I've made or coming to a show. I think that, in part, that one of the things that both Rage Against the Machine did, and perhaps with Prophets of Rage and with this Atlas Underground record, is, you know, first and foremost, I'm a musician. I'm trying to kick your ass by making the record and play a show that's going to be one that you're going to remember for the rest of your life. Now, if the art is compelling, then you might be exposed to a different set of ideas than in other music that you've heard. And I can't go to the grocery store without somebody who coming up to me who wasn't influenced by Rage Against the Machine in a way that it influenced their point of view, if not dramatically changed it. But I've always been very, very open to that. Like, I grew up in a small, conservative, Midwestern town where some of the views that I held as a youth and as a teen were not particularly progressive. And if some band had said, you're not welcome in our audience, for me, it was Public Enemy and The Clash really helped open my mind to different ideas. And then even bands, I have to say, like, sort of like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, like bands that, like, with the idea of overcoming my homophobia as a teen, opening me to like new ideas and different people and ways that they think. Music is a great conduit for that. Always.
And for reducing barriers.
Absolutely, reducing barriers. Now, do I want to, you know, become more united with Klansmen and Nazis? No, I want to smash them. But with regard to having an open tent to listening to music and having it be a way to communicate, certainly on this Atlas Underground record, comes out this Friday, the lyrical theme is social justice ghost stories. And what we do on this record is we tell the stories of heroes and martyrs of the past to inform the struggles of the present and hopefully light a fire under an audience to change the future and make it a more just and humane one.
It's a very noble goal. Getting back to what each person can do, we have elections coming in less than a month now, and many states that you've visited so far on this tour, and Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey, right in this area, are coming up on the deadline to register to vote. I saw a thing on the television this morning where they went to UCLA, and they're talking with all these young people, and they go, "Are you going to vote?" "Nah. Why not? Oh, I just, you know, don't feel like it." It really saddened me because more than ever, and it tends to be the younger people who have got this right to vote and who don't exercise it. What would you say about getting people out to vote?
Well, I mean, when you look at who actually votes and the percentage of baby boomers who vote versus the percentage of millennials who vote, it's shocking. Like, you wouldn't let, you know, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s control, you know, what you watch, who you date, like what sort of work you can have, but you're going to let them control the country and you just abdicate. The way I look at it, if there's been one common theme in the music that I've made in my entire life, it's to insist that the audience recognize that they are agents of history. And history is not something that happened. History is something that you make and that you have your hands on the steering wheel of history. And any progressive, radical, or revolutionary changes ever had, whenever things have changed for the better, it's because of people just like your listeners. They didn't have any more power, courage, intelligence, or creativity than anyone listening to this right now. They just stood up in their place and time to do what was right. Now, that's one option. Or you can abdicate, and you can be on the sidelines, and you can let other sons of bitches drive this planet into the ditch. The choice is up to you.
Speaking of activism, I want to take you back and conclude here in Philadelphia, where Lollapalooza, when it was a touring festival, I think it was the summer of 1993, there had been a large stadium, JFK Stadium. It got torn down and was essentially probably an asbestos-filled dust bowl. But they put on Lollapalooza there that particular summer, and Rage Against the Machine came out in a most unusual fashion. For people who are too young to remember it, tell us what it was, and then tell us what it was like.
Sure. Lollapalooza, the original touring festival, was what kind of really created an alternative music nation out of America, you know? And we were opening up that day. We were the first band on stage that day. And at the time, there was a pro-censorship organization of Washington Wives called the PMRC, the Parents Music Resource Center, that was trying to censor metal and rap and put stickers on albums. And so that day in Philadelphia, we decided we're going to do a protest against the PMRC. So our entire performance as a band consisted of the four members of Rage Against the Machine walking on stage, buck naked, with the guitars feeding back, with
no socks on,
with electrical tape over our mouths, and the letters PMRC written on, you know, each of our chests. And we stood there butt ass naked in a football stadium. And for the first, our tour manager had figured that we had like 15 minutes before the police came to arrest our naked selves. So for the first 5 minutes we were out there, people are cheering. It's like, it's Lollapalooza. It's Rage Against the Machine. They're naked. Three of them are well hung. It's awesome. It's awesome. It's awesome. It's awesome. Then for the second 5 minutes, there was this kind of odd standoff where they're like, 10 minutes is a long time for no music to be happening with dudes just glowering at you nude. And so people were like, I don't know what's happening. Is this art? Is this what? Then for the last 5 minutes, they were furious and people were throwing quarters at our dicks and they were booing and giving us the finger. And then the show was over.
Wow.
And that was it. And the idea was, you know, you cannot take for granted controversial music. You may have to fight for it.
Was it bizarre to you doing it?
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. Like, whose idea
well,
was
I mean, it was a collective idea. But, yeah, it was certainly bizarre doing it. But, you know, that from Rage Against the Machine to the Atlas Underground, the idea has been to sort of challenge conventions and to do stuff that's both musically and politically outside the box to hopefully make people think and to rock them.
And that happened right here in the historic village of Philadelphia, where this whole experiment, as Bono calls it, this idea of America began right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that idea of America continues. It's called The Atlas Underground. It's a new Tom Morello rocking solo album with multiple collaborators from Wu-Tang Clan to Marcus Mumford, Big Boy, Killer Mike, Bass Nectar, Knife Party, Rise Against, Steve Aoki, Portugal the Man, Gary Clark Jr. Perhaps you heard of him. He's on the record, too. Anyway, so check it out. It's a record I'm very, very proud of. And in a town like this that appreciates rock and roll, that's what we're going for.
All styles of music, because musicians don't know boundaries. And someday, my goal is to see Tony Bennett cover Green Day's Basket Case.
It may very well happen.
Thank you, Tom, for speaking with us on MMR.
Cheers. Thanks very much. Hello, this is Tom Morello, and you're listening to Pierre Robert on 93.3 WMMR. MMR and Pierre rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.